Good afternoon. Is this machine working? Okay, yeah. It's actually a very special pleasure for me to introduce Myrna Gopnik to you. About 5 years ago, I guess it was now, I read a paper of hers, quite by accident in Nature, wasn't, so to speak, looking for it, about the beginnings of the work that she'll be talking about later. And I remember sitting there and thinking, well, you know, maybe for the first time this kind of work gives us a chance of studying the evolution of language. And I'd already got round to realizing that this was, in a sense, the last of the major transitions in evolutionary biology, the origin of human language. And here at last was a tool that one might actually use for studying its evolution. So I think I knew at once, it's one of the, sometimes you read a paper and you know at once that this is important, this is actually going to help to make real progress. And I followed her later work, I've had the pleasure of meeting her, of hearing her talk. But I should perhaps add one other thing, that there is an important sense in which Myrna is a better sociobiologist than I am. As those of you who know about sociobiology will understand, sociobiologists are judged by their inclusive fitness. I have only managed 3 children and 5 grandchildren. Myrna has, I believe, 6 children and 9 grandchildren. And I mean, I'm sure she's still going strong. and I'm not. So I fear that she has overtaken and surpassed me in that important respect. She's going to talk to us about genes, grammar, and other curiosities. Myrna. I'm going to go down where I can see you.
I'm very pleased to be here this afternoon, and I could not be more pleased than to have someone as distinguished as John Maynard Smith introduce my work, and to have him say that it's interesting is probably one of the great rewards of doing this work for the last many years. I'd like to start with, I guess, what's everybody's Bible for this series. A quote from Darwin, and it's quite clear that what he sees, that in fact that we will be able to answer some of the questions, as he says, in the distant future, about the necessary acquirement of each mental power and capacity, is now coming to pass. It's been 140 years, but now we are being able to answer some of these questions, and I hope that the work that I'm doing will Charles Darwin also said at another time that language was in fact an instinct, that language was clearly part of the biological makeup of man. It was different than normal instincts in that it needed some learning in order for it to get going. Now, between Darwin's speculation and the current times, there was a long period in which people denied that there was any biological basis to language whatsoever. There were 2 sources to this. There were the behaviorists who said that everything was learning by some very simple learning mechanisms. And there were the relativists who are back among us again, who held that every language and every culture was radically different than every other one. If they were radically different, then it was obviously true that there couldn't be any biological properties to this. But Noam Chomsky, as everybody knows, about 30 years ago, reintroduced the speculation that there were some universal properties of language, and at least parts of language, and I should use the word grammar, non-semantic parts of language, had at their basis some fundamental biological, were governed by some fundamental biological principles. Chomsky suggests that there's a language organ much like the heart or lungs. Now, the one problem about this is that we know how to investigate the biological history of hearts and lungs. We can do it in 2 ways. We can look at other extant creatures who manifest the same sorts of structures, or we can do it by looking at fossil remains. Unfortunately, language does not fossilize, and there is no extant animal that has anything like language. So we really are have a problem before us. We have to find some other way of getting knowledge about this. The fundamental hypothesis here is that the acquisition of language is dependent on a particular neural substrate, and that genetic factors determine or control or influence the course of neurological development. You can then speculate, if this is the case, then there could be a mutation in this these genetic factors which would change the neurological substrate and thereby interfere with the acquisition of language. Does this mean that I think there's a gene for grammar? No, I do not think that there's a grammar gene. I'm always misunderstood about this. And so I want to say it loud and clear, no, I don't think that there's a simple genetic switch, which if you have the gene, you have good language, and if you don't have the gene, you don't. It's much, much more complex than that. There's clearly a complex interaction between the intrauterine environment, probably polygenetic factors, and other kinds of compensatory problems of the neurology that lead to this disorder. So now what we do have, and I think this has been known for a long time, we have a natural experiment. There are children who are born, and this is a kind of definition of what people usually talk about in this case. They have problems in developing their own native language in the absence of any general perceptual, motor, general cognitive, emotional, or social problems. This is the kind of clinical definitions. We'll see we have to clean this up a little bit later on. But in general, clinicians, for as long as there have been clinicians, have been seeing these children who have particular problems acquiring language. And this seems to be a kind of natural experiment that we can look at to see if there is any genetic basis. Now, one of the things, if we can characterize this population, is they don't have major problems communicating. That is, they do use language. They are not mute. They use language reasonably fluently. They can understand concepts like numeration and sequence of time, but they don't seem to be able to encode these reliably in the grammatical features that we use in English of number and tense. The difficulty occurs across all modes. It occurs in spontaneous speech. It occurs in spontaneous writing. It occurs when you ask them to make grammatical judgments about sentences, when you ask them to rate sentences for whether they're grammatical or not. It occurs in online and offline tasks, in for real and novel forms. We've tried to be reasonably creative in the range of different tests, because sometimes if you give them a test by saying the words out loud, somebody says, they can't hear too well. So then we give it to them in writing, and then they say, maybe they can't read. So then we give it to them in writing where they read it aloud to us. And so we've tried every kind of variation we can about the testing situation, and I can assure you that we see the same sorts of deficit no matter what the form of the stimuli or what the form of the response required. So our team now is investigating the linguistic, genetic, and neurological properties of this disorder cross-linguistically. I cannot do this myself. I am not a geneticist or a neurologist, and I don't speak Japanese and Greek fluently, but we have, as you can see, a rather large team of people looking at all, taking the same subject population and looking at all the different modes that we can of this subject population. And who are these subjects? Now, this is a little bit hard. We've looked in Canada for several, for families. We have so far 61 French-speaking families and 12 English-speaking families. This is a manifestation of the sources. The speech pathologists have another 7 English families coming on track. We've tested 62 individuals in English and about 46 in French, 20 in Greek, and 20 others in Japanese. So as you can see, we've got lots of data from lots of different subjects across 4 different languages: English, French, Greek and Japanese. The reason we did that is because any particular thing that we might see in English might be a property of the peculiarities of English. And what we wanted to do is to see if this disorder is the same or virtually the same no matter what language you look at. Now, that's all well and good to have this subject pool, but the question you're asking, obviously, is there any reason to believe that this that there's any genetic basis for this disorder? We've just examined 58 of the families. We tried to be as careful as we could. We had someone go and check the medical records of every one of the probands and to exclude anyone who didn't meet this initial criteria. And we ended up with 58 clear cases. And of those, as you can see, somewhat over 22% have an affected first-degree relative. Somewhat over, just under 30% have an affected second-degree relative. And less than 50% have no affected first or second-degree relatives. Our data, in fact, agree almost exactly with other data. So there's been lots and lots of family studies. We were not the first to do this epidemiological study. And in every case, the controls, that is, the probands with no history of family impairment, have fewer relatives that are afflicted than those who have a clear family history. So it's quite clear, I think, that this disorder aggregates in families. Well, as some of you might say, so do recipes for chestnut souffles and bad jokes. The question is this familial aggregation truly pointing to a genetic problem, or is it merely that this family has a funny kind of dialect, or that the mothers are speaking differently to these? There, if you look at the incidence in families, you'll see that only some of the children in the family are affected. For example, in one family with 9 children, 4 are affected and 5 are not. This makes it very hard for it to be a family dialect if only a scattering of the children are affected. Could it be the way the mothers talk to the children? Well, we know that mothers adopt caretaker speech, that is a different kind of prosodic structure. But we also know that they can only do this to things which are under their conscious control. You can consciously decide to have shorter sentences. You can consciously decide what level of words to use. No one can consciously decide that they are going to mark plural in English or tense. If I said to you, I want you for every other sentence to not use the past tense marker when it's appropriate, you probably couldn't say a word. These things are simply not under conscious control. Furthermore, when we look at the structure of the language these people produce, we can see it has properties which don't match the universal properties of any language that we know. That makes it a very bad candidate for a dialect, because a dialect is a kind of language, and what they produce looks very much not a kind of language. But we also have some real data that can argue to this, and that is twin studies. There have been, so far, at least 3 different twin studies, one by Dorothy Bishop at Cambridge, one by Bruce Tomlin in Iowa, and one by Lewis and Thompson. In every one of those 3 studies, what they show is that identical twins, monozygotic twins, are much more concordant, in fact, concordant to 90% with this disorder than are dizygotic twins. This is, for geneticists, I understand, convincing evidence that what we're seeing is, in fact, a genetic disorder. We know that there is some incoming, some reason to believe, for example, that dyslexia is linked to the short arm of the 6th chromosome. So we know that other language disorders seem to have some genetic basis, some clear genetic basis. We think that this will, too. Now we're going to move over. Let's suppose I have persuaded you that there is some genetic mechanism underlying this. Let's go to the second half of our hypothesis, that what this genetic disorder is doing is interfering with the establishment of the neural substrate. That is, somehow it's building different kinds of brains. Now, one robust piece of data that all of my neurologist friends tell me is absolutely certain is that about 95% of individuals have language encoded on their left hemisphere. This is not very difficult to ascertain because every time someone does neurosurgery, they want to know where language is, so that there's hundreds, if not thousands, of studies of where language, which hemisphere language is encoded on. And as I say, 95 to 98%, depending on the particular study, show that it's on the left hemisphere. The question is, what is it about the left hemisphere that guarantees that if you, when you're acquiring language, that you stick it on the left hemisphere? Here we're in much more shaky ground. Early studies by Geschwind et al. Said about 65% of individuals had a larger planum temporale on the left hemisphere. My friends in neuroimaging tell me that was an artifact of the planar system he was using. When you look at 3D pictures of the planum temporale, that falls apart. Someone just 2 days before I left said, "Ah, no, but it's not in the in the cortex. It's in the gray matter. The white matter is much more myelinated on the left hemisphere than on the right hemisphere. That means it can have many more connections." What do we know? Well, Alain Plante has done a lot of studies of MRI studies on these subjects with language disorders, and what she finds is that there are atypical perisylvian asymmetries. In other words, that the two hemispheres are much more symmetrical. That's what atypical is, that they're symmetrical, not asymmetrical, in these families. Now, the problem with this data is that this asymmetry occurs in members of the family that don't have the language disorder, and there are people who do have a language disorder that don't have this asymmetry. I just spoke to Elena three days ago to find what was new, and she says she now has new MRIs that show statistically significant differences in posterior morphology for familial subjects and anterior morphology for adults, whether they're within or not within family aggregations. One of the problems we have is that the tools we have, we know what the question is, but the tools we have to answer it are not sophisticated enough yet for us to convincingly answer this question. But I have, I think, some of the cutest new data. I won't have time to go through it all. Ken Watkin at the Royal Victoria Hospital in the OBGYN section has developed a brand new technique for interpreting ultrasound images. And he can get ultrasound images of fetuses of the neurological development that shows the gyri and all of the other major structures in 3D. They're quite beautiful pictures. And what he's done, the newest data that we have, is from one pregnant woman who comes with a positive family history. That is, she has lots of people with this disorder in her family. And another pregnant woman, actually, we have six, but we don't have the final data on five of them, who has a negative family history. Nobody in her family has this disorder. And I will go through this rather quickly. And what he finds is that there is significant differences between the two fetuses. He looked at 24, 28, and 32 weeks. Significant differences in the volumes of the right and left hemisphere. The one with a positive family history has significantly more growth on the right hemisphere than the left. And then he did it by sections, and he found the most statistically significant area in which this was true was the inferior middle area of the brain, which is where language is encoded on the left hemisphere. And so I have some other the data for that, but I don't think we have time to go through it all. So here's what we see. Yes, they're both males. They're both born now, too, so we are sure they're both males. For the negative family history, we can see that the left hemisphere has a greater volume than the right at 24 weeks, at 28 weeks, and at 32 weeks. The opposite is true for the one with a positive family history. By the time you get to 32 weeks, you see there's a huge difference between the right and left hemisphere. Now, problems. I don't know if this fetus has any language problems. I couldn't figure out a way to give any language test to a 28-week fetus, nor I don't think the mother would agree. So we have no notion. We will be following this child very closely. But when you look at Plante's data and you look at this data, it at least is suggested that something interesting is going on. Over the next few years, I'm sure, as the techniques improve, we will be able to get better data. We also have some very interesting suggestive ERP data, and we're now doing MRI scans on a number of people. Now, if this is true, that there's some gene that interferes with neurological development, it is perfectly reasonable to ask whether or not, to suppose that this gene might have consequences for other cognitive systems. That is, that this genetic factor could, in some case, affect other cognitive systems. And also, since we have been selecting our subjects just on the basis of their language problem, when we finally find the genetic factors that go into this, we might find that we know that spatial rotation, spatial problems also aggregate in families. And we might find that the same genetic factors could, in some cases, spare language altogether. So the problems, the philosophical problem we have is that the data we have don't distinguish between those just language and only language being affected. In fact, there is abundant evidence for heterogeneity among the this clinical population. Paula Talau would say they have trouble with temporal processing. Larry Leonard would say they have problems with auditory processing. Paul Fletcher says they have problems with articulation. Some people point out they have problems with reading, with spatial rotation, with symbolic play, with block building. In fact, we have a neurologist who's testing our, running all the standardized neurological tests on these, and we have a subject who has language problems who also has problems with hopping on one foot. So that there's a wide range of other kinds of problems. The question is, are these other problems causally related to the language problem, or do they merely co-occur? We know that for every one of these problems, there are individuals who have that problem who don't have language problems. So it is not true that all impaired people have any of these other problems, nor only those people have other problems. In any event, the only way we can test the causal hypothesis is to look in great detail about what kinds of problems do they have with language. Because each of these various hypotheses has to make clear predictions about what it is that it would be affected in language. For example, if you say it comes from their problem to hear and hearing or their problem to articulate, then the things that are most at risk are those things which are either difficult to hear or difficult to articulate. We can ask the question as to whether or not that's true. So it seems to me that the first thing that we have to do in order to test these other causal hypotheses, which I think are unlikely because of their distribution, but even so, is to provide a good linguistic description. So we've run hundreds of tests across four different languages. And what we found is that we see the same pattern across all languages, across the four languages we've looked at. This is just English and French. The English impaired show that kind of pattern, and the French impaired show virtually the same pattern. The first test is a pointing test, which is used to determine whether they can hear the sounds involved. So you say something like point to the book or point to the books, and you want to see can they distinguish these things. The second test is a test of grammaticality judgment. Is this a good sentence in the language or not? The third test is a test of derivational morphology. This monkey is very curious. He has lots of curiosity. The third is a tense-changing task. Every day I go to the store, yesterday I. And the fourth is syntactic comprehension. They have, we read a sentence and they have to point to a picture. The impairment is the specific language disorder as diagnosed by the clinicians. Or someone in that same family who had a history of language disorders, because the older generation hasn't been diagnosed by clinicians because there were no clinicians then. And this is the same data in Greek. And you can see exactly the same pattern of impairment across all languages. And in fact, the reason that the numbers are lower in Greek is because Greek has many, 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 I have the numbers, like 140 different forms for inflected verbs. In English, we have three, or four maybe. So if you have to make a decision in English, you don't have to choose from as large a sample. So we think that that's what's lowering the numbers in the Greek. That is, we predicted that that's the pattern we would see. And if we look just very quickly at one test, the judgment of grammatical errors, we can see that the normals are in the 90% range, and the English, Japanese, and Greek impaired are all at chance, essentially. We then asked them if they judged a sentence was incorrect, we asked them to make it better. And what we found out is that just asking them whether a sentence is correct or incorrect isn't sufficient. You have to really ask them to correct it to see if they really know what they're talking about. And as you can see, they're even worse at that. So if you give them a sentence, I guess my favorite one is, the boy eats three cookies. And the person said, no, that's not a good sentence. Can you make it better? Yeah, the boys eat four cookies. And we find this across the board in Japanese and in Greek. They may say the sentence is wrong, and then when you ask them to make it better, they sometimes change a totally different part of the sentence that has nothing to do with the error. So they're worse at the grammaticality judgment task than even the numbers look like. And we have some data from bilinguals. The hypothesis should be, if we're right about this, if someone is bilingual, they should have the same problem in both languages, and they do. This is one bilingual boy, and you can see he has exactly the same problems in both languages. He makes precisely the same kinds of problems in not being able to change tenses, in not being able to, and in not being able to do derivational morphology. And when we look, it's not only, what's interesting is, not only the fact that they can't do this, but more importantly, the kinds of errors they make. They make characteristic errors. The errors which they make are different than the errors that normal controls make. For example, as you can see, they substitute words. This monkey is very curious. He has lots of bananas. The normally developing children always know the kind of answer that you're supposed to give. But here's a different bilingual boy. And what we gave him was a series of pictures, and we asked him to please tell us a story from these pictures. This was transcribed this weekend, last weekend. So what we found is that in both French and in English, he was not able to produce the same tense throughout. He made errors in, for example, a man and a woman looked up in a tree and see the nest. And he does the same thing in French. The other thing that he does is that he uses a lot of, lexical phrases to tell you about the time that something's happening. And after, or puis après ça in French. So we see precisely the same devices in both of the languages. An inability to control tense marking and a tendency to use lexical items to mark the concept of temporality. He wants you to know what happened after what, but he can't just do it by using tense marking. Now, the question is, obviously, whether or not any of these other hypotheses can really tell us what's happening in language. I thought I might spend a minute or two on the most popular two most popular hypotheses, I suppose, that it's either something in the auditory system or something in the articulatory system that prevents these children from producing these forms. As I said, that doesn't make sense when you see how widespread this is. But we can look at some of the evidence that we have to suggest, the linguistic evidence, that this isn't true. As I mentioned, in all of these languages, we have used tests to see if they can make the appropriate phonological distinctions. This happens to be one in Japanese. And the reason we use this is that this distinction between a voiced and voiceless sound is very important in the morphology of the language. As you can see, the impaired do better than the controls on this. They have no problem distinguishing those two sounds. That makes us believe that it can't be purely articulatory, but we have lots more evidence. We tried very hard to find some instances. Now, very often in English, if you take plurals or past tenses, they are marked by very little sounds. Walked or boys, you might say, well, that sound goes by too quickly. And we tried to think, where could we find something in English that was really perfectly clear? And the answer was in the comparative system. There are two forms of comparatives in English, the ER one, big, bigger, which is hard to hear, and the more one, expensive, more expensive. What do we find? They're even worse at the more than at the ER. One of the reasons is, as we'll see, that the ER forms are more frequent than the more forms. And that these ER structures could be learned as single words. You could learn the word big and you could learn the word bigger, but you can't learn expensive, more expensive. You have to produce that each time. And so that seemed to indicate, too, that what was going on was really grammatical and not articulatory or auditory. And now we have data from Japanese. So if I had more time, I would explain the details. But for you, those of you who are not fluent speakers of Japanese, I will just say that there are two kinds of verbal morphology in Japanese. One of them that makes the difference between the price of rice rises and somebody raises the price of rice. This is encoded in the middle of the word with an A and this with an E. So this is agaru and this is ageru. Not a very big, significant sound difference. And then there's syntactic morphology. The difference is that these forms have to be listed in the dictionary. It only applies to some verbs, and these verbs are listed, everybody agrees, in the dictionary. This process can happen to any sentence, and so it's generated by rule. And look at the forms. They're much larger, that is more phonologically salient. Os areta and os aseta. Everyone would agree that are is easier to hear than a, and ase is easier to hear than a. But what happens? We can see that for the ones you can list in the dictionary, they're very good. For those that have to be generated by rule, they're very bad. So now we've got two places, at least, where the prediction from the auditory hypothesis would go in exactly the opposite direction than the data go. And I guess I'm enough of an empiricist to say I like to listen to the data when I can, even when it goes against my theory. There's a little anecdote I guess I couldn't tell. We just came back from Japan a week ago. And while we were there, we were listening to the news in Japanese because they also had things in reports, unfortunately reports mostly from here about bombs going off in London that were in English. But the whole context was the Japanese, was in Japanese. And I kept hearing this word, mashite, mashite, throughout the whole program. And finally I said to one of my Japanese friends, what does mashite mean? I hear it all the time. And they laughed and they said, that's the verbal ending. That's the polite past tense ending. You just weren't paying any attention to what went before it, which was the main verb. Now, mashite then, I can vouch, is extremely easy to hear. You cannot not hear it. And yet, in our Japanese data, The children do not produce or recognize that sentences are wrong when mashte is not in the sentence. So there's another piece of data that suggests it cannot just be auditory. So now what do we think? Well, our hypothesis is really quite simple. It may be wrong, and probably is in some respects, but at least it's testable. We think that the language-impaired subjects do not build certain kinds of, they don't produce regularly inflected forms by rule. We think that they have two compensatory mechanisms. Some of them are very, very bright, and they can, over time, learn how to, in a sense, how to simulate these structures in language. And they can do it in two ways. They can memorize the forms as in the same way that we do irregulars. So, for example, everyone here has learned and memorized that the past tense of go is went. You don't have any rule for producing that in English. You just have to know that that's the case. That's not true with walk walked. If I give you any new word that you've never heard before and ask you what the past tense is, for example, if I say, I have to fax my office. Yesterday everybody knows instantly it's faxed. Those are produced by rule in your language. What we think these people are doing is learning everything as if it were went. That they have, if they hear the word walked in past contexts, they can perfectly well learn that it means to move around in the past similarly to went. The other thing that they can do is that they can learn explicit simple rules and learn how to apply them. Most of these younger subjects have been in speech therapy for many, many years. One of them has been in speech therapy for at least 14 years. So, and they're taught simple rules, and we think that they can learn them. And I've made this claim, I've got to prove it to you. So let's look at some of the kinds of data that you would produce. As I said, all normally developing speakers of English can do these kinds of tasks without any problem. As soon as you have the word faxed, you can do all kinds of, you can produce all the inflected forms that you could ever dream of. Now, how can we then test to see whether or not they're producing productive rules? If they sometimes produce the word walked in spontaneous speech, it could be that they have the rule and they just don't know that you have to apply it all the time. So what we did was we said, okay, the real test is to test them on novel words, words they've never heard before. If they're good at this kind of, if they have a productive rule, then they should be able to produce these. Standard test we gave. One of my graduate students turned out to have very good creative artistic talents and drew us, I think, 100 different sorts of animals. This is a wug. These are, for four-year-olds, this is not a difficult task. And for people your age, it's certainly not a difficult task. We did it not only for nouns in English, we did it for nouns, we did it for verbs, we did it for comparatives. Wonderful pictures that said, this pencil is weff, this pencil is even. So what do we see? These are the data for novel inflection. I didn't have a chance to add the French data, which has just come online, but it looks very much like the English data and the Japanese data and the Greek data. As you can see, in every single case, in every one of the tests that we've given that involved the production of novel forms, the impaired were significantly worse than the than the controls. In fact, I think it's the case that every single one of the impaired was worse than every single one of the controls. So this isn't just a statistical mean, it really happens to each individual, that this is an extraordinarily hard task for them. Now, this is an interesting number, and I will later on discuss this in more detail. This 27% right for past tense is true if you give them credit for producing anything at all at the end of the word, whether they say walked or walked or walked, you say, okay, they produce something. What we will see later is that it's very crucially important to look at the precise form that they do produce, and that's what gives you these kinds of numbers, that they really get virtually none right. But we'll look at that later on. So we can see that when you test the hypothesis that they can produce things by rule, it seems that they really have problems. So when they, on occasion, let's say 35% of the time, or even for some of them 80% of the time, produce an existing word that looks like it's past tense in spontaneous speech, our hypothesis is that they're doing it by this memorization route. But that's a hypothesis. I'm going to have to prove that to you. And so now we have two, if you believe that they didn't produce the words by rule, I've got to try to convince you that they're really memorizing these. And we have three kinds of evidence that they're memorizing these. One is that if they're not memorizing it, if they really know about inflected words, they should be able to know where the root boundaries is. That is, where the cut is between the root of the word and the inflectional ending. The other piece of evidence that we can have is there's a very robust effect that has been duplicated a million times, and that is things which are memorized are subject to frequency effects. That is, the more frequent you've seen or heard something, the more likely you are to recover it from memory, except for names of students. So now, this turns out for normal speakers of a language not to be true about something which is produced by rule. You are no more likely to get walked right than you are likely to get faxed right. If you have the rule, there is no frequency effects. And this is, Steve Pinker, for example, has barrels full of data that this is the case, that there is this significant difference. So if we see that these people have frequency effects, that would be another piece of data. And the third piece of data that I won't have time to go into is online processing data, but I can mention that if somebody's interested. Well now, if I had time, I would give you a little mini course in Greek compounding. But we don't have time to do that. All I will say is that the reason we have to look at Greek and Japanese is because English has a very bad habit of allowing uninflected roots to surface as real words. So we believe as linguists that the word walked or the word walks is made up of the root walk plus the past tense form ed. But we also have the word walk in the language. So if somebody says walk, we don't know if it's because they know where the root boundary is or they're just familiar with the word. So we needed languages in which no bare roots ever surfaced. And this is true about Greek. You cannot produce a noun in Greek without having some inflectional ending. Every single noun has at least 8 forms. Every single verb has roughly 140 different forms. I did not list them all. So the question then is, can Greek impaired subjects, do they know where the root is? Do they know the difference between a root and an inflection? Now, obviously, we have the same problem if they are producing a word which actually exists, you can't test it. And here is the Jenny Dalalakis, who is a wonderful, absolutely terrific graduate student, thought of this test. She took young Greek speakers in Thessaloniki and in Athens, that is, they had no exposure to any other language, they were genuine, absolute Greek speakers. She tested them, she's a native Greek speaker, she tested them in Greece, in Greek. And the problem was the following. Here is a wolf, Lykos. Now, Lyk, L-I-K, is the root in Greek. And here is a man, Anthropos, who becomes a wolf. The word lycanthropos, werewolf, is in fact known in Greek. It is an existing word. But you can bet that here is a mouse, here is a man who becomes a mouse. Pondik anthropos, meaning mouse man, is not a word that they have ever, ever heard. So now we have a test to see, can they take the word pondikos and know that pondik is the root to produce pondik anthropos? Now, you know what the answer is. No, they can't, but we have the data. They're terrible at this task. You can see that the normals, by the time they were 5.5 years old, were at ceiling levels. The best of the impaired subjects was almost 18 years old, and he was at 46%, which is not terrific. But what was even more interesting was to look at the kinds of errors that these younger normals made and that the impaired made. Because that's where we're going to really get the evidence. And so here we have Greek error types. One of the interesting thing is that not only couldn't they find the right root, but sometimes they produced a piece that was too short. So instead of producing anthrop, they produced anthrophagos. Sometimes they put in extra stuff. So persimmon should be lot, and this should be lotphagos, and they produced an extra S. Then they said lotosphagos. We have been terribly careful in all of these cases. The person who did the experiment is not the same person who transcribed the tapes. We had other Greek speakers transcribe the tapes and other Japanese speakers transcribe the tapes. So the experimenter who might have a bias about what he thought the tape should say were not the person who produced the transcriptions. The transcribers were blind to the hypothesis. Now, what does that mean? If we look at the developmentally language-impaired subjects, 81% of the errors which they made, of the 50-some percent errors, were root errors, were errors in not knowing where the root boundary was. Age match controls only show 1% of such errors, and young controls only show 5% of such errors. Now, the young controls, in fact, do make errors. They make errors, something which I didn't tell you about. Okay, I'll just mention it. In some cases, under some phonological conditions, you have to put an O between the two roots. The young controls overgeneralize that insertion of O. In other words, they have a rule that's too rich rather than a rule that's impoverished. And one of the funny one of the funny consequences was when I made up that thing about faxing, Jenny read the paper and said, oh, Professor Gopnik, how clever you were to presage the Greek data in your example. And I said, what are you talking about? Faxophobia. That's the Greek rule for O insertion. I said, I had no idea I knew the rule for Greek O insertion in Greek compounding. Here I am, having heard maybe a dozen such words in Greek. And I have automatically, unconsciously extracted the rule for O insertion. And all of you would have said faxophobia too, so all of you know the rule for Greek, for O insertion in Greek compounding, so I don't have to tell you about it. This 17-year-old boy has lived in Greece his whole life and heard probably thousands of instances and still can't extract the rule. And we see the same thing, I will go quickly, in a process of compounding in Japanese called rendaku. In rendaku, you have to put together two words. Everybody here knows one, at least one example of rendaku, origami, which comes from ora and kami. One of them means paper and the other means folding, and I always forget which is which. If there's a Japanese speaker, they can enlighten us. Now, what happens is that we gave them cards with the two words on it, or I should say, Suzy and Shinji Fukuda tested Japanese speakers in Japanese in Japan. And this was also transcribed by people who didn't know what the hypothesis was. If you put together the two words, this is a frequently occurring word. The word for long and the word for shoes, when they get put together, the word naga plus kutsu comes out to naga gutsu, and it means boots. This means field of carrots, and it is an occurring word, but it's not very frequent. And this is a new one, goldfish, one that just doesn't occur in the language. And you can see that the impaired subjects get worse and worse and worse depending on how frequent this form is. They have a great deal of trouble producing this kind of compound in Japanese as well as the Greek compounding data. So we can ask, what are the frequency effects? And we have lots of frequency effects across languages. We have them, I actually didn't put the Greek data on here. We have frequency effects for Greek noun, Greek pluralization, for rendaku, and for English past tense production. We have a Michael Ullman and I did a rather lengthy test of past tense production in English, which should be coming out shortly. I laugh because he is very slow in writing. And there was, it was perfectly clear in the past that they there was a strong frequency effect. That's also true in rendaku, and it was also true in the past tense, with one problem about the frequencies of past tenses, which I can tell you about later. Okay, we also have online data in which the subject didn't know they were being tested about this. And it shows that they seem to be insensitive to the fact that a word is inflected. Now, their being insensitive sometimes can hold them in good stead. The Greek subjects were given all of these compounds, and they were asked whether or not this compound was a word in the language. They were much faster than normals in deciding which, they were good at knowing which ones existed and which ones didn't. But what was interesting is they were better than the controls in judging that something was an illegal compound. The reason is that the controls, having all these rules, have to take time to go through and check that both roots are there, check that the inflection is right, check that O is inserted correctly. Our hypothesis is that all of our guys have to do is go up to their dictionary, run through and see if it's in the dictionary, and then make a response. So the online data looks just like the offline data, and we're getting new data from French and English, but it's not in final shape to present to you. The last thing I want to mention is this hypothesis that they're doing all of this by rule, by a rule that they've learned. Not an unconscious rule like three-year-olds do it by, but a rule that someone intelligent who has been taught these things many times can, in fact, do this. Now, here is a dialogue from a 19-year-old language-impaired man. I had just run him on that past tense task, which had 30 existing regular past tenses, 30 existing irregular past tenses, and 30 novel past tenses. And in the novels, he got 9 right out of 30. Well, now, most of the controls got 28 or 29 right out of 30. But he did much better than his mother, who got 1 right, or his grandmother, who got 0 right. So 3 or 4 days later, I said to him, how do you know what word would go there? And he said, look at that, pointing to the word on the, because this is a written test, and put ED on it. And how do you know that? Learn it at school. Notice learn in the present tense, not in the past tense. And what was the rule you learned at school? in the past tense, then put ed on it. If it's today, ing, like swimming. I went swimming today, and yesterday I swam. He's really good at this. He's learned the rule, and he knows how to apply it, kind of. I mean, he knows how to apply the rule he was taught. The problem is that linguistic rules are much more complex than that. The rule for past tense says many things. One, you can't apply past tense to something that's already past mark. You only get to apply it once. Second, that the phonological form of the ending has to match the phonological form of the root. Here's another person. And I could go on. We have lots and lots of examples of these kinds of what they say about what they're doing, from Japanese to. This was a pluralization task. And the woman says, she was supposed to give the plural of crab. And she says, crabs. You have to put a S to it all the time. And she proceeds to do just that. For vub, she says vubs. For fen, she says fence. For tuss, she says tuss. For pras, she says pras s. Now what's clear is that she's not producing the standard form. And not only that, now here's a problem for the articulatory guys out there. The form she's producing is harder to pronounce than the normal form. What she's trying very hard to do is to, in fact, apply the rule which she believes is the rule for pluralist, well, for something in English. And if you look at the stress pattern in this, you find out what she's really doing. And I have to say, this is Heather Goad at McGill University was the did all of these analyses and had this idea to begin with, and it worked out to be, in fact, true. What she's doing is producing a form that looks much more like a compound in the language. It looks as if she's taking the word tuss and adding a little word s, which for her means more than one. So tuss means the word tuss plus lots of. So this is kind of like lots of tuss. Now, these kinds of anecdotal stuff don't get you home free. What we need is some real hard data. And we have that from, Heather has now looked at about six impaired people, and she's also looked at a lot more in other domains. This is one impaired person. On the nonsense word task, she produces 10% that are undistinguishable in terms of whether they're correct. Now remember, if she's going to use the S form, she's right sometimes. If you give her cat and she says cats with an S, she's right. So that's why we call it correct like. We think she's doing the same thing, but we can't prove that. 71% of the time she's producing an explicit plural. 7% of the time she's producing a real word substitution. And you can see, even with existing words, about half of the time she produces an explicit plural. Well, I don't know if I have, yes, I, to make this speak and talk faster, I cut out some of the data. I have the data, if anybody's interested, of the unimpaired subjects. The worst of the unimpaired produces an explicit plural 9% of the time. Most of them are in the 1% or 2% range. This is two more impaired subjects. And you can see that they're producing these explicit plurals with very high frequency. And guess what? We see the same thing in Japanese. So these are nasal voiced obstruent final. I guess the data from Japanese, if anybody's interested in the Japanese data, I can show you later. What's crucial is they were asked to produce the past tense of verbs in Japanese. And you can see that, again, the frequent words they're not so bad at producing. They're not nearly at the level that you would believe that it was produced by rule. The non-frequent, they're even worse. And the novel ones, they're falling down bad. But they're even worse at the novels because they produce exactly the same kinds of explicit plurals in Japanese that we saw them producing in English. So the ones that look as if they're past marked, in fact, are explicitly marked. I'll just give you one more example, and then you can ask all the questions. This, if I want to make this claim that they're learning these things one at a time, we have data from a notebook of a young boy. Every Monday, he had to come in and write down what he did over the weekend. So we have him from the 12th of September to, I think, the 17th of May. These are just two pages, but the pattern is the same throughout. The things in red are the teacher's additions. On Saturday, I watch TV, and I watch Plastic Man, and I watch football, and the teacher puts in red the corrections. Monday, October 17th, is the first time he uses watch again, and as you see, he gets it right. Unfortunately, he also says, I got up, and I washed myself, and I got dressed, and I eat my breakfast, and I watched TV. So he has learned the past form of watched, but he hasn't learned the generalized rule of past tense formation, and we can see this throughout the year. The teacher corrects it, he gets it right the next time he uses it, and then he produces a word like play or something else. I watched TV and I play in the schoolyard. So he seems to be learning it, but learning it in a totally different way than any of the control children. So it looks as if, in fact, I think the data is reasonably convincing that they are not constructing rules and they are using these compensatory processes. And I would like to now echo Darwin and say that in the distant future, I see open fields for far more important. Psychology will be based on a new foundation, that of the necessary genetic and neurological contribution to the acquirement of each mental power and capacity. Light will be thrown on the nature and origins of man and his history. I left plenty of time at the end for questions. I have plenty more data, and I thought I would like to have your reactions to this, what may seem to some of you a radical hypothesis, which may seem to others in the audience as perfectly reasonable data.
During the discussion, could I ask you, we're not going to bring you around a microphone, but speak loudly, and I will repeat the question from here so the rest of the audience can hear it. And and announce your name, because it's sort of nice to know who you are. But Myrna, I'm going to leave you to choose the people, because I'm semi-epic, I can't see.
I can choose people I know, I suppose. Now, I left plenty of time at the end because I thought there would be a lot of discussion. I can go on and give you much more data. Yes.
Isaac Marks. Can you say a bit more about what these SLI people are better at than average? You mentioned one thing.
I'm going to repeat that.
Yes.
The question is, are there things that the SLI people are better at than others?
I don't think that I can say that they're better at any other. I mean, that is, that they don't have compensatory skills in any other domain that are reliable for the whole group. What we see is a pattern across these children and adults of differential other cognitive performance. Heather von der Lely has data from several children that suggest that they are perfectly good at cognitive tasks that require them to generalize from data that's not linguistic data. And I have a little bit of data in that same regard. That is, it is not true that all of them have this general problem, the general cognitive problem of, if you give them, for example, a Wisconsin card sort task in which they're given four cards and they have to predict what the rule is that gets them to be all the same. They can be quite good at those kinds of tasks. Now, the real problem, I spoke about the articulatory and the auditory hypotheses. I guess one of the most fundamental alternative hypotheses, not to me, but to Noam Chomsky and the linguists, is to question the notion that language is modular at all, to suggest that there is no special language instinct. that language arises in the same way as any other cognitive generalization arises. That is, that there's some cognitive learning mechanism, a connectionist mechanism or some other mechanism, that has the child learn all kinds of things about the world and about various cognitive domains. And language is just another one of those things that children have to learn, that there's nothing special about language at all. The data that Heather Vonderlelly has that suggests that these subjects are good at other kind of cognitive tasks would suggest that at least it is not true that there's any easy answer about what's cognitive. I'm always put in the position of not being able to deny that there might be some cognitive model that would account for all of this linguistic data. All I can say is no one has yet proposed a model that does it. I'd like to stay agnostic as to whether or not such a model could exist. And that's why I would say we have to just get the linguistic data out there in great detail and then say to someone, okay, now come up with a model. The other part is also true that many people have pointed out that some of these individuals have cognitive deficits. The problem is that it's never true that all and only these subjects have that cognitive deficit. Judith Johnston, for example, suggests that they have problems with spatial rotation. That may be the case, but it's very hard for me to imagine a model, a cognitive model, that would account for a difficulty with spatial rotation and a difficulty with learning about tense. Maybe someone will be much more ingenious than anyone has been now and convince me that this is the case, but I think they'd rather co-occur. But they don't have any special great talents.
We have a question here first, and then we'll come to you.
Christopher Badcock, John Maynard Smith gave a talk about your work here some year or two ago, and in the course of it, he showed us a genealogy for SLI, and he said it looked very much to him as if it was a single autosomal dominant gene with high penetrance.
Yes.
You agree with him? And
I won't answer that part of the question. I of course agree with John. How could I not? But
if you agree with him, do you know where it is and what this gene codes for?
The answer is that one family looks as if it's an autosomal dominant gene. Unfortunately, when we look at the 107 other families, we don't see that same clear pattern. My geneticist friends tell me it's likely to be polygenetic. We are very, as I mentioned, dyslexia has been shown to be linked, no, certain subset of people who are dyslexic, that is a certain subset of reading disorders have been shown to be linked to the short arm of the sixth chromosome. They do not know yet what this codes for. We expect that we will get the same sort of answer for this population or for some subset of this population. This is likely to be a heterogeneous population. And we don't know if in that single family what we have is an autosomal dominant gene or if that pattern is just an ascertainment bias in that particular family. We have some families in Canada that we are just now testing. Unfortunately, or fortunately in England, they tend to stay put. In Canada, everybody tends to roam. And we have the same family in Montreal, in Quebec City, in Alberta, Canada, and in BC, and we are just now testing it. And that family has many individuals who have the same disorder. So we may just be seeing different kinds of patterns in different families.
I'd like to come back to the genetics later, if I may. But
yes.
You were, what got to say? Yes.
Jim Kennedy. Well, could you say something, say more about the incidence of SLI?
Okay, I do
the
both.
The questions concern both the diagnostic criteria for SLI and the incidence.
Yes. Oh, the age of the subjects that we have been testing. Well, let me go one, two, three. Diagnostic criteria are that they have to have auditory acuity over, I think, 40 decibels. Does that make sense? I'm not sure of the number, but there's some particular number that they have to, in other words, their hearing has to be non-impaired. They have to show no signs of schizophrenia or autism. And they have to have IQ, performance IQ within the normal range, which means over 85. Now, we do have one subject who has a performance IQ of 70, but it occurs in this large family. And when you look at her language deficit, it looks exactly like. So we have made the corollary to say that the proband has to have these properties. But if we see someone else in the family who has language deficit, then we might question some of the other criteria. What we see in terms of performance IQ, I think it is fair to say, is a very wide range. So even in this family where one might say there's a mean difference between the impaired and the unimpaired, you find out that the range overlaps. So you have one person who has an IQ of 84, who has no language deficit, and someone else who has an IQ of 111 and has a serious language deficit. So it looks like performance IQ does not correlate. Now, age of the subjects. They score at least 20 points different on the verbal versus the performance IQ. And most of them, all of the subjects we have looked at have been diagnosed as language impaired, all the probands, by a clinician who has actually sampled their language. And they have been referred to us by hospital or school clinics. That's not entirely true. There's also an association of parents of children with this disorder. And they have also self-referred, I think, three subjects. And then after that, we give them a diagnostic test. And then we tested our test against the familiarity. We gave them a screening test, which I showed you the results of in French, Greek, German, French, Greek, Japanese, and English. And what we did was we had people grade the test blind to knowing whether or not these people were impaired. And then we had people determine the diagnosis. And we found out that we were something like 95% correct in those who had, 100% correct in those who had been diagnosed as language impaired. And about, I'm not sure of these exact numbers, 85 to 90% correct in those who had no impairment, that is, we said they didn't have. And then there was a group that were probably impaired, and in that group we said about 40% of that group had real language impairment. That's because when you do the family studies, you include, for older people, criteria like, were you ever left back in school? Do you have any problems reading? Much broader range of disorders. We hope that we can get better diagnosis if we're right about this, that they're using different processing strategies. Then it should be the case that we can see these if we use some online measures, both online testing and EEGs and ERPs. So what we hope we can do is that someone who is very well compensated, has learned a lot of these rules, might be able to trick our test. For example, the father of one of the impaired children in Canada. His wife says he's language impaired. I have spoken to him, and he's a computer scientist and designs switching systems for Bell Northern. And he speaks more slowly than anybody I have. His wife says he doesn't like to speak. He doesn't like to speak to strangers. I said to him, I was at his house testing his sons, and I said, oh, that's a wonderful swimming pool. How long have you had it? I have had that pool for 5 years. Silence. This is not a chatty individual. We gave him our language test, and he got everyone right. But it took him forever to do the task. So he would sit there, and we'd give him a sentence like, yesterday I walked to school. He would sit there and think about it, and finally say, no, that is not a good sentence. And he could tell us why it wasn't. But you could see the wheels turning. So we want very much to get this ERP and EEG system up and running. We have it now. It should be at this very moment, people are being tested on it. And we hope we can then have a better diagnostic. How old are the people? We try not to, we don't think we can reliably test anyone younger than 7 or 8 years old, because we want to know things like, do you think this sentence is grammatical? We have some devices that we're going to try on younger. We have a test to use for younger subjects, but what we're trying to do is make life easy for ourselves and use older subjects. The results I showed you were from a 22-year-old man, from an 18-year-old. The oldest subject we've tested is now, I guess, 78. We've tested the parents of these probands. We're now getting subjects, which I don't have any data to report on, from a school in Montreal called the Vanguard School, which is a school just for children with language disorders, and we have some 12 and 14-year-olds who are coming on. So we think it happens earlier, but I don't think the kinds of questions we want to ask about the details of grammar we can rely on the answers of 5-year-olds. So. Well, don't forget, if you look at our other numbers, we've tested 250 to 300 controls. So for every single test, we have run the test on controls, and you can see the kinds. We've done two kinds of controls. We've used members of the family who were not impaired, who were not diagnosed as impaired, so that we could see if it's a family dialect, if it's socioeconomic or something else. And we've also used controls outside of the families, and we found that the controls in the families and controls outside of the families did exactly the same, and you can see the numbers. We try very hard to give them easy tests so that the controls are in the 98% scale. And so that's the only way we can know that our tests are not picking up, normal variation, is to give it to a large number of controls and use them as the controls for the interpretation of these results.
You have to wave your hands wildly because I'm blind. There's something back there, yeah. I think I'll just repeat that.
Sure.
Probably. I may get it wrong, but I'll repeat it. But I think the crucial question is, could the problem simply be a context difficulty, namely that people fail to recognize that a past tense is needed rather than not know the rules for constructing a past tense? And secondly, since in Chinese there isn't a formal past tense but much context information, does the condition show up among the Chinese? Is that right, or if not, please? Okay.
The second question first, if I can. Yes, Chinese is a wonderful example of a language group that has been very successful, since there are approximately a billion Chinese, that doesn't have these kinds of morphological rules. Now, if you take another group like the Inuit in northern Canada, they have an incredibly complex inflectional system, and there's only, I think, 30 or 40,000 of them. Now, I don't know that we can infer that these inflectional systems affect your reproduction, but it may be that you take so long to figure out what the tense of the verb is that you... Anyway, I will leave that go. We have... what that does is raise the question, about the origins of language, and that is, why do we have morphological systems to begin with? I think that this is, in a sense, one of the more interesting questions to ask. Not why do these people have problems with constructing a morphological system. I think that's interesting. I wouldn't have worked on it for 10 years. But it raises exactly the question that you're asking. If morphology is part of and parcel of this kind of innate mechanism, why is it that we get languages with such a diversity of inflectional systems? Turkish, on the one hand, with an enormously complex inflectional system, and Chinese with virtually no inflection, no morphology at all. Nobody knows the answer to that, so I don't mind not knowing the answer to it. But I think it's a question that isn't even posed enough. We have some Chinese speakers. We have some identical twin boys who are both Chinese and English speakers. But Chinese is their second language. Their father speaks Mandarin, their mother speaks Cantonese, so that they don't have any single language which they have learned. So it's a much more difficult case. And it's hard to find a context in which to test them whether they have this problem in Chinese, but it's an interesting question. As to context, one of the things that we have seen with these people is that they have no problem in numeration or in temporality. That is, they know perfectly well what things are more than one and what things are later. They know the sequence of events. So for example, if you look at the story that we gave, that is a series of six pictures, their stories always reflect some hypothesis about the order of the events. So for example, I don't know if I had the example at that point where someone says he climbed the tree because so-and-so, and then he fell out. So they give causal relations, they give all the kinds of contextual patterns that you would expect from someone who knew about the sequence of tenses. And more than that, they do seem to use these lexical markers of number and tense, of number and time more often than the unimpaired members. So they seem to understand the problem. Now, it might have been that they had the rule for past tense, but they just didn't know that you had to use it every place. It's kind of a contextual notion that the question would be, the auxiliary question is, why do they ever use the past marked forms? And our hypothesis is that if we're right that they're storing it lexically, they have a word that means to happen in the past. If they've already told you it was yesterday, then they don't have to use that particular word. They can use a word that's neutral for tense marking. So I hope that helps answer some of them.
I think we have time for one more question. Yeah.
Yeah, that was going to be my problem is, if we don't think that any of these other creatures have anything like language, I wouldn't know how to answer that. I suppose what we can do is we can wait for, and now I have to turn to John, 10 or 20 years until we find the gene sequence. Then we can look at a mouse and say, does a mouse have this sequence? What is it coding about neurological development? What is it not coding about neurological development? But you can't answer that question from the point of view of linguistics because, except for Mickey, very few mice speak. But we can answer the question in the far distant future when we know what the gene sequence is and we can then test to see what's happening in other animals.
I mean, if I could make a comment there, because it's closer to my trade, it's most unlikely, I think, that the genes today concerned with the language organ, and it won't be just one gene locus, but many physiologically, were doing nothing. I don't think they could possibly have come from nowhere. Our whole experience in evolution
yes.
is that a new organ is a modification of something that was doing something totally different. But I think you're right, Menard, we will only know what that something different was when we have the genes and we can sequence them and say, aha, that used to be for visual analysis or for singing or, you know, something else.
Yeah, one person who has given some data in this regard is Pat Kuhl from the University of Seattle, And she has shown that certain, there people had pointed out that newborn babies sort sound categorically. If anybody's interested, I can privately go into this. And what she's shown is that so do chinchillas and monkeys. So there was a thing that looked like it was language specific that turns out to be general. But she's also now shown that there's something that turns on at about 5 or 6 months that reorganizes the sound space in a way that she's tested it in monkeys and has not seen it. So those are the kinds of questions that people are asking is, certainly some parts of this system, and I guess the last thing I'd like to say is I don't think there is such a thing as language. I think that linguists and the rest of us speak facilely when we act as if all of these, there's a single unitary thing. It's likely to be made of several, it is certainly made of several subparts, each of which I think have a different genetic and phylogenetic history. The auditory system for structuring sounds, some cognitive system for marking things like past and numeration. And they all come together in us, and what the source is of, I think you can't ask a question as where did language come from? I think you're going to have to ask a question of where did categorical perception come from? Where did productive morphology come from? And then it'll be, as Darwin says, in the far distant future, there will be researches much more important than ours.
Well, not too far distant, I hope, because I want to live to see it, and I haven't been too long. We must break for tea now, and I hope tea available in the foyer outside the theatre. And we'll be back here, I hope, in half an hour. Thank you. Unplaced, unsituated in time and in place. The third type of theory we often have aren't really theories at all, because again, I think there's been with the growth of primatology, there's been a tremendous tendency to believe, or to recognize, is a better word, to recognize that primates, and particularly the apes and the chimpanzee, are capable of extraordinary things that they were previously not known to do. They have linguistic abilities, they have some understanding of grammar, they have tools, they have hunting, they have social cooperation, they have politics, they have all these things. And because they're there in embryo, to some extent, the problems of human evolution can go away, because there isn't really anything to explain, because there's been no change. Everything is there, and it's just extended or elaborated. And so I think there are a whole series of theories to be found in the use of primatology, which are in effect saying there is no change. Now, it's clear that there is an enormous amount of change in human evolution. Of course, in that direction lie a whole group of other theories, which say that there is so much change that this can't be anything to do with evolution. This is simply a major aberrant change and so on. So that if we use the primates and we make comparisons with them, it seems to me a good theory has to account equally for both the similarities and the differences. It is no use to simply focus on the fact that chimpanzees either do have language or don't have language, or that they do use technology or don't, but we have to try and explain the areas where they are both similar and both different. And of course, there's a lot of methods in evolutionary biology to do exactly that. So a good theory should take into account similarities and differences. We have a whole series of theories which I won't dwell on, which I think of as off the beaten track theories. Now, the idea here is really that human evolution is such a phenomenal thing that it cannot be accounted for in terms of the usual rules of evolution. It's a major deviation from the normal path. There are all sorts, some of these are totally limited. This is my favorite book on human evolution. Actually, my second favorite book on human evolution. The best is a book called The Evolution Man by Roy Lewis, which is a novel about human evolution. Well worth reading. It's extremely funny because the whole of human evolution takes place in one family. Ends up with patricide. This is my second favorite book, which is Man, the Fallen Ape. And it's a very strange book about human evolution. It again says things are so weird in human evolution that we need weird things to explain it. The weirdness here is that I think we're the product, if I remember it rightly, we're the product of miscegenation between orangutans and chimpanzees somewhere in the Arabian Gulf a few million years ago. That explains the emergence of it.
And it seems to me that there are a lot of theories in this way. A much more carefully thought out example would be the aquatic ape, where a primate trajectory is diverted in a major way by an excursion through into the into an aquatic phase, and this explains the differences. Underlying all these, I think, is the idea that good old-fashioned traditional Darwinism isn't powerful enough to explain the patterns we see. Wallace himself started this tradition with, of course, his rejection of natural selection as a mechanism to account for the evolution of human brains, human intelligence, and so on, and the recognition that other factors are coming in. So, again, here it's a question of taste. Personally, my view is that we always should start with Darwinism. We should start with the expectation that we ought to be able to, a theory ought to be able to account for something as phenomenal as humans in terms of fairly straightforward mechanisms. We don't need necessarily to be looking for the aberrant pattern in evolution. This doesn't necessarily mean that new things are not going on. And another area where theories of human evolution have been both very, very strange but also quite fruitful is, of course, the idea that with human evolution, new mechanisms are coming in. This is not where humans have gone off on a different track, but a new mechanism is in operation, and as a result of which it changes the rules of the evolutionary game. The simple view that some sort of cultural evolution is replacing Darwinian evolution, and that as we progress through from ape baseline, or whatever baseline you want to take, through to modern humans, we have the gradual replacement of one evolutionary mechanism by another. I think people like Boyd and Richardson have done a lot of very fruitful work in these co-evolutionary models, and I think they are an extremely important part of understanding it. But of course, what we have to remember is that because these mechanisms are not in place at the start of the process, we cannot assume their existence at any point in trying to understand human evolution, but have to try and see how they might emerge out of the ordinary workings of an evolutionary mechanism. So again, I would say that if we're going to try and come up with a theory of human evolution, it should, in principle, start from the ordinary Darwinian mechanisms. Now, usually most debates about theory can get very heated, and at the end of which, the question I usually have in mind, what was the question we were originally starting to argue about? And it seems to me that many theories are, in human evolution in particular, are problematic because we're not absolutely clear what is the question that we're dealing with. Few of the seminars or lectures one goes to in animal behavior go by without somebody mentioning Tinbergen's four questions and how important they are for understanding any behavioral problem. As long as nobody asks me what they are in the questions, somebody here, I can never remember what they are, but there's four critical questions that all behavioral ecologists and behavior people know, and that understanding those four questions, which are essentially the why, the how, developmental aspects of evolution, means that you don't make the mistake of, as it were, seeing things in conflict where they're not. And many aspects of human evolution, many theories of human evolution, I think, do tend to muddle up a number of different issues. And if we just look here, if we're looking at evolutionary change, it seems to me that when we're looking at humans in particular, the consequences of human evolution are, of course, massive. I mean, the sheer scale of the human evolutionary endeavor, in demographic terms, is so vast that it's incomprehensible. So we have major consequences. It does not necessarily in any sense mean that the causes and the conditions under which those first initial steps should be taken should be anything other than very straightforward, ordinary processes. Equally, I think we tend to muddle up the conditions and the causes of evolutionary change. There's a lot of debate, for example, in brain, the importance of brain evolution and the role of different factors in brain evolution, which is often posed in terms of whether brain evolution is driven by ecological factors and energy, or whether it's driven by social factors. Nicholas Humphreys' social hypothesis, the sort of ideas that Robin Dunbar, who's just published a new book, so he's a friend of mine, I'll say you should go and buy it, because it's all full of the social hypothesis in evolution. But of course, it may well be that while the causes of brain evolution are primarily social, that is, that individuals who are able to pursue complex social games because they have large brains have a higher reproductive success, the conditions under which social complexity might emerge, or the conditions that allow large brains to grow, could be entirely ecological. They could be dependent upon energetic factors. And I'll come back to that. And that there are always constraints operating too. And we see a lot of, say, in discussions about bipedalism, a lot of, I think, confusion in these areas. Finally, the question of explanations. When you talk about what is the theory of human evolution, what we have in mind is how do we explain it? How do we explain why human evolution occurred in the way it did? Now, of course, that what that really, putting the question that way, brings us to the recognition that human evolution is not a unique problem. It is just the evolution of a particular lineage. And so in that sense, evolutionary questions, I think, are just, or human evolutionary questions, are just part of the broader field of evolutionary biology. Of course, once you get out into that murky area, there are lots of arguments about exactly how does evolution take place. So that if, again, we start with evolutionary change, one would take the strictly selectionist Darwinist view, one might argue that evolutionary change is the product of adaptation, that natural selection produces changes which enhance reproductive success and organisms adapt to their environments, and evolutionary change is a product of adaptation or goes hand in hand with it. But of course, out there are a lot of people who would argue that natural selection isn't powerful enough. Stephen Gould has suggested many times that that there are all sorts of phylogenetic factors, that there are historical contingent factors which greatly inhibit the operation of natural selection. Others would argue that there are many chance and random elements in it. And of course, equally, with the growing importance of molecular biology, that there are clearly mechanical molecular processes which inhibit the way in which biological systems can work. So that you end up with perhaps recognizing that evolutionary change could be the product of a number of different mechanisms, and the question is, which one should a theory pick on? In the end, I think it has to be a matter of taste. But what I would argue is that any theory of human evolution should be consistent with a theory of evolution as a whole. We shouldn't be looking for something special, but we should just be having another day's work in the on the coalface of evolutionary biology with humans, rather than starting out with anything very special. So having said all that, what should a good theory of human evolution consist of? Here are a number of criteria. One could come up with some more. It should, I think, be related to the appropriate evolutionary question, and we should recognize there are lots of different questions out there that we could answer, so we're not going to have a single all-embracing theoretical framework. Most importantly, it must be context-specific. Human evolution did not occur in the Cretaceous. It didn't occur in the Arctic. It occurred in particular places at particular times, and any theory should take that into account. I think, I should presumably hardly need to say this in this audience, that I think it should be Darwinian in the first instance, and my expectation is it will be primarily Darwinian, and any movement either away from Darwinian mechanism would have to, I think, be justified if the data didn't fit Darwinian models. I think we need to go beyond the living species as the framework in which we explore evolutionary problems, and in particular, and I shall talk a lot more about this, we should identify the appropriate evolutionary and chronological scale as being, we should recognize what the scale of the problem is. And indeed, we're not dealing with the origins of a whole new phylum, we're not dealing with something that's happening over hundreds of millions of years, we're dealing with a particular evolutionary historical problem. And finally, as where I started, we don't want to set out to explain too much. I'm very suspicious of theories that account for the whole of human evolution, which, of course, is why my way of getting out of the fact that at the end of this, I'm not going to come up with a complete theory of human evolution. In fact, I'm not even going to come up with a theory at all. So the structure of a theory should be similar to the structure of the theory of any other evolutionary problem. And there's one more thing, and this, I think, will be the main point that I want to get across this afternoon, and that is that human evolution is, in fact, not a single event. It is made up of many events that occurred in the past over a very long period of time, dispersed geographically and phylogenetically. And so what we're after is not a theory of human evolution, but many theories covering the different aspects. I've been told by someone that today is Einstein's birthday, and someone in the front row's birthday, As a result of it being Einstein's birthday, perhaps we might start to think about grand unifying theories in biology to match those that they might find in physics. And I would say that it's premature. So we shouldn't perhaps be looking yet for the gut, the guts of human evolution. So I've told you then that human evolution is made up of lots of events, and that's what we need to explain. What are these events? Well, this is where the fossil record, now of course this is all to soft soap you into looking at some fossils and to talk about fossils, which are an esoteric taste. But what are the events? Well, the events, of course, we can only observe through the fossil record. It's only the paleontological record that can tell us something about what actually happened. Now, we can infer a number of things from the present day. We can infer a lot about what happened in the past from the present day, but we have to remember we're inferring it from the survivors. Most of the things that happen in evolution involve populations dying out, extinction, and so on. And that, of course, those are the things that don't survive through to the present day. So if we want to see not just the survivors, but the context in which evolution takes place, we have to turn to the fossil record and use that as a framework, I think, for constructing some theories. And the growth of the fossil record will itself, I think, tell us quite a lot about how what one calls sort of presentist dogma, in other words, using the present to define the past, can be restricting. And if we look at this graph here, what it shows is that the number of taxa that have been discovered in the fossil record since the first one, the Neanderthals in the 1850s, and we're up to now about 16 species, give or take a few depending on how you classify things. But this is really quite a major shift. So that back there, out there in the past, is not the ape man, the missing link that people expected, but an awful lot, too many ape men and missing links. And if we look at these a little more closely, and here is their temporal distribution, so the horizontal line gives the age in millions of years, what we find is that, I'll go for a walk now, if we look at the distribution, at no point really along this line do we ever find only one species. It's not a simple anagenetic process. There's a lot of clearly a lot of splitting, a lot of speciation going on, and up here we may not really know what is a species, but clearly there's an awful lot of diversity. There's a lot of contemporaneous diversity at all these periods, and indeed this little blip here where we do have one species is extremely unusual in the whole of this evolutionary history. So we've got this range of taxonomic diversity. Now, of course, that is telling us the story of human evolution, but I think it's doing something else as well. When we look at the problem of human evolution, and particularly the place of humans in the world, what we are doing, the framework we adopt if we look at living species, is to compare ourselves to chimpanzees. So the great Rubicon that things have to cross is the Rubicon of Pan. What can Pan do? This provides us with the baseline. So we have this evolutionary distance that Homo sapiens has to cover. So, of course, when people look, and people, particularly people who are critical of evolution, say, well, the gap is too great. But, of course, what the graph I've just shown you a moment ago showed that, in fact, this distance is not real. This distance is a function of extinction. These fossils that we've discovered, and here's the range of them, and this is their approximate extinction points, that they fill in this space. And so this provides us with a very different type of perspective as to how different humans are, modern humans are, from other species. And in case you say, well, that doesn't really matter, they did become extinct, we can simply say, well, what happens if they didn't become extinct? Supposing, again, in one of my parallel universes, these species, after the cladogenesis that produced them, instead of becoming extinct, they actually survive through to the present day. So that when we go to game parks in East Africa, we don't go just to watch chimpanzees and gorillas, but we might say, I really want to go and have a look at Homo rudolfensis, which has some very interesting sexual habits or something in East Africa. Had they survived through, then this would be, say, with Neanderthals, would be the evolutionary gap that we would be arguing about in our in evolutionary terms. And of course, this extinction, it's the extinction is happening without anything, as it were, happening on the other end, the evolutionary end of things here. So the difference between humans and other animals is not necessarily occurring because humans are evolving anymore, but might be occurring because other species are becoming extinct. And Darwin, of course, pointed this out himself. I don't know what they performed here last night, but there's all sorts of things on the floor. Darwin himself pointed this out when he argued that the gap, the extinction, would get the difference between humans and other animals would increase over the next century, as he argued the what he called the uncivilized races became extinct, and as the anthropoid apes became extinct, so that in say 1,000 years time, the gap between humans and other animals would be between humans and perhaps baboons, or maybe even something more distant. And yet all this would happen without necessarily evolutionary change occurring. So the fossil record then provides us with an important framework for understanding both the pattern of evolution. And of course, to my mind, it tells us something else, that many of the things we see in evolution are actually driven by extinction. I think extinction is tremendously important in the way evolution works, and one of the underlying driving forces, and I'll come back to that, again, something you can only study through the fossil record. And of course, it changes the data as well. If we just look at just something very simple and fairly meaningless relationship, probably, which is just brain size and the area of the first molar, in extant sister clades, here's humans, modern humans, here's chimpanzees, we might be tempted to see some relationship here, or not, another two points that I can draw a line through. And if we then look at all the extinct hominids that we now know about, we would miss this extraordinary excursion into massive tooth enlargement that takes place, and then reduction possibly in association with increase in brain size. So the types of relationships that we're going to look at, or might want to look at, can be very greatly affected by what species are coming in, and that again can be a function of extinction. So what then, I suppose I've argued so far that what we need are several theories, and theories that are context specific, because human evolution is made up of a series of events, and I've tried to persuade you that those events are not just things that persist through to the present day, but have been lost through extinction and are accessible only through the fossil record. So now, my next task, as it were, is to try and identify what are those events in the fossil record, so we've got a slightly better idea of what it is we're going to set out to explain. Now, this is going to be one of the quickest surveys of human evolution ever, but I just want to try and identify some of the main patterns that are occurring. It'll be very familiar to many of you. The first evidence we have for hominids comes from Africa around about 5 million years ago, from Ethiopia at the moment, Eastern Africa generally, in the Rift Valley. And what we find there are things that look something like this, and that is ape-like forms with many of the modifications associated with bipedalism and the shift in the shape of the pelvis to a more human-like form, but retaining many ape-like characteristics, still essentially an ape-like brain size, the face is large and prognathic, the shape of the thorax is ape-like, and these long elongated arms, relatively long arms, curved phalanges. In other words, what we have here is some shift towards bipedalism, but without necessarily any other change at all. And I think the pattern of the first part of hominid evolution, which is the Pliocene, from about 5 million years down to around about 2 million years ago, is essentially a story of African apes in parts of Africa. So that round about 5 million years ago, this eastern portion of Africa here was subjected both to climatic changes, affected by climatic changes across the Indian Ocean, producing a drier eastern seaboard here, at the same time as you get a lot of rift development down this eastern part here. You get the development of the Rift Valley. And the African apes, who were presumably, although we have very little evidence for this, located in this central region, are best understood as an eastern extension of that. And what we're seeing, I think, is primarily an energetic and ecological shift. We're seeing an ape-like form which is merely adapting to a new type of environment and is doing so primarily through its locomotor pattern. So we're not seeing any major changes in behavior. This is adaptation to a savanna environment. The other adaptations we see are this increasing tooth size, which I shall refer to, the increase in the molars. And the other aspect of this whole period is that moving into this eastern rift and rift region exposes them to the rift corridor, because there is, in effect, a corridor that runs down the eastern side of Africa as a means of faunal exchange, faunal movement between eastern and southern Africa. So, and north up here and across, as we now know, into Chad, this Chad region. So moving out into this region produces a kind of a ribbon of habitats for hominids. And I think what we see in there is the scope for enormous allopatric speciation. And so as a result of that, this Pliocene period is a period when we get lots of species. There are lots of different types of hominid out there, all the Australopithecines, and just in the last year we've probably had two, or last two or three years, we've had two new species named. There may well still be more taxa out there of this form in both eastern and southern Africa. But of course, while there are lots of species, they're still very much confined to Africa. As far as we can tell, there's no evidence for extension outside Africa. So the Pliocene then is a period of bipedal apes. So if you're interested in the Pliocene, we're essentially interested in these ecological changes occurring then, rather than any of the major things that we say. My guess is that it's very little to do with language and culture and technology. There's certainly no evidence for any of those. The second change, or the second period, is from about 2 million years ago. We're now into the Pleistocene. We see something slightly different. This is one of Richard Leakey's finds, WT15000, the Nariakotomi boy, again from eastern Africa. It's dated to a little over 1.5 million years ago. And here we see something I think which we would all recognize as being rather more human. The proportions, the overall postcranial bodily proportions, are much more those that we would associate with ourselves, with humans. So we're seeing the change in the chest, the change in the limb proportions, now of a full biped, rather than the ape-like bipedalism associated with the Australopithecines. And also, for the first time, we're beginning to see some signs of an increase in brain size. And the major event, or the major processes that are going on, is for the first time hominids begin to spread out of Africa. Increasingly, it looks as if there are hominids in Asia, in Far East Asia, between 1.5 and 2 million years ago, and certainly moving into Asia, occupying parts of Asia by a million years. Europe was probably occupied somewhat later, and of course other parts of Africa were colonized. And so what we're seeing is a much broader distribution of hominids during this phase. It's not by any means a pan-global distribution of humans the way we see it today. What we probably have is small, isolated populations, widely dispersed, probably very separated from each other. And this goes along with something we also see, that while there is a common theme to all this, there's quite a lot of diversity. There's tremendous diversity in hominid morphology at this period, stretched out over this much larger area than during the Pliocene. The dispersal certainly shouldn't be thought of as a sort of one-off, you know, long trek, the grand march across Asia. What we're probably looking at is a whole series of movements and expansions and dispersals and extinctions of what is essentially a robust, archaic form of Homo. Similar to us in overall morphological form, but much, much more heavily built, smaller brains, but for the first time, increasing capacity compared relative to the African apes. And so I think the way we should perceive the Pleistocene is essentially as an unstable world. Remember that the climatic changes of this period were very marked. You have a whole series of oscillations in climate as you descend into the Ice Age. And that unstable world is the world of the robust, heavily built, heavily muscled, archaic, Homo-like forms, which are very much intermediate in many ways. And then, finally, we move into the Upper Pleistocene, where what we have in the Upper Pleistocene, that is the last 125,000 years, I'd actually extend that back, what we're dealing with in the last 200,000 years or so, is, as it were, the last of these series of dispersals, the last of these movements, and the loss, the end of this archaic world. And for the first time, we begin to see modern humans evolving, almost certainly in Africa, from small, localized, variable populations distributed around Africa, and dispersing out over a prolonged period of time. This is these are the ancestors of modern humans, ancestors we've heard a lot about in terms of mitochondrial DNA and mitochondrial Eve, the African population, but not necessarily, or certainly not a single dispersal, but multiple dispersals of variable populations from Africa, possibly going back in terms of dispersals as far as 100,000 or more years ago, and then gradually over the subsequent 100,000 years, particularly accelerating after about 50,000 years, expanding into the northern parts of the world. We've probably got two routes. These are maps from Mata La, showing essentially a southern distribution and dispersals out here with fragmented populations within Africa. A tremendously dynamic demographic world over this period, culminating with, of course, the major changes that archaeologists have referred to as the Upper Paleolithic, the appearance of changes in behavior found primarily in Europe and the Mediterranean, some parts of Asia, occurring around about 40,000 years ago, but associated with the first evidence for art, the first evidence for symbolism, greater tool complexity, and as far as we can see, much more increasing population density. But the thing I would emphasize here, this is not a single event that happens with Eve or any other or any great dispersal, but it's a continuous process successively occurring over 150,000 years ago, and indeed continuing through to the present day. In effect, we're still seeing these dispersals and movements and demographic changes. The origins of agriculture, one of the things about this chronology is I think it brings the origins of agriculture, which occur in parts of the world around about 10,000 years ago, very, very close to when modern humans actually reached these areas. It's a continuous demographic and geographical process occurring over a prolonged period of time. So here we have, again, instability, movement of populations, essentially a lot of demographic changes occurring. Now, that very, very... one other thing I forgot. And, of course, what occurs during this period, the other thing is that this is when we get the evolution of the morphological, the population, the geographical diversity that we can see today. So that these are all modern human crania, the variation that has evolved in this last few tens of thousands of years. Now, if that's the pattern of human evolution, the question, or the next question that's prompted, given the title, that do we need a theory of human evolution, what we need to know is what sorts of theories might account for this pattern. How do we set about explaining the pattern that we can observe in the fossil record, and of course one that is consistent with what we know from other lines of evidence that we might want to employ. And the first point that I want to make, and this goes back to what I said earlier, it's why we don't want a single theory of human evolution, that there can't be a single theory of human evolution because there are lots of events. Just looking at those three, I could break it up much, much more finely and look not just at the Pliocene, the Pleistocene, and the late Pleistocene. One could look at a whole series of different events and try and ask what happens in each particular case. And so there won't be a single theory, although, of course, what may be the case is that there are a number of generalities underlying the explanations which apply to several of these events or all of these events. They might all be driven by climate, or they might all be driven by social competition or something like that. But we should start, I think, with a specific before moving on to whether there is a general theory. So how do we explain then the particular theories that we have? I think I will skip that. That's my phylogeny. I always put that on just to show that I occasionally think about phylogeny. Take it off before anybody can criticize it. Turning to the first of these then, hominid origins, as I've already intimated, I think the problem of hominid origins is nothing to do with the problems of the human evolution. Human evolution, as the evolution of all the things we've been talking about today, language and culture, and whether there is an instinct, a language instinct, or anything like that. This probably has very little to do with human evolution in that sense, going back here. It certainly sets all the groundwork for it, producing perhaps bipedal apes and so on. But it wouldn't be too difficult to envisage a world where the apes, the bipedal apes of Eastern Africa, had just died out under different climatic circumstances and nothing more had happened. And evolution, human evolution, may have occurred elsewhere. So hominid origins, I think, in effect, a problem to do with ape evolution and to do with the evolutionary and environmental changes that I've already talked about, the development of the Rift Valley and the sorts of exposure to environmental and habitat loss that was going on at this period. You have to, the late Miocene was a period of quite major climatic change across the eastern side, where the great rainforest areas were being fragmented and producing much more open environments, and I thought in particular much more mosaic environments, much more variable sets of habitats, which I think have important implications. So in effect what we're dealing with is some sort of ecological change. Now that doesn't mean that then that there's nothing interesting to say about hominid origins and how it might affect the way humans have evolved. And I'll just show you two things drawn primarily from looking at chimpanzees, which might be interesting. The first is if you look at evidence on day ranges in chimpanzees, what we find is that in dry seasons, the chimpanzees and Gombe chimpanzees and elsewhere too, they will forage far further. In other words, the drier the season, the drier the habitat, the greater the day range. So drying out habitats are not just going to change whether there's particular environments in terms of thermoregulatory effects, but they're actually going to change the distribution of resources and how far an individual have to forage. And we also can see by looking at community size, that is in chimpanzees, in relation to rainfall, in particular to rainfall seasonality, that the greater the amount of rainfall, the wetter the environment, then the greater the community size of chimpanzees. And that in very dry environments, it looks as if chimpanzee communities become quite small and fragmented. So one of the things that we could perhaps just extrapolate through to hominids moving into these, or perhaps just already being there in these drier environments, is the sorts of pressures they're going to put on their both their foraging, their ecological activities, and also their social communities that will occur. And this is, again, nothing terribly aberrant in terms of moving into great new plateaus of social evolution. It's going to be the working out of relatively simple, or maybe simple is the wrong word, but of the general principles of behavioral ecology in terms of particular habitats. And indeed, it is interesting if so much of human evolution is about increasing group size and increasing social complexity, if the initial stages of it, of hominid origins, are actually more associated with a reduction in group size and a collapsing of the larger communities. Of course, it's been suggested in terms of the other factor, the extensive ranging, that bipedalism does impose a number of energetic advantages, and that the need to forage much, much further and to forage on the ground as well as in the trees and to travel between trees is a major factor in bipedalism, but has very little to do with, the later changes. If we look at later, slightly later hominid evolution, in other words, once we're beyond hominid origins, we have all these multiple species in the Pliocene, all the Australopithecines. Here I think we can learn something else about the sorts of explanations, and that is that they don't seem to show any great inclination to evolve into modern humans. They seem to show a tremendous enthusiasm for teeth. The main trend in hominid evolution, early hominid evolution, is megadontic. That is, that they're becoming, these molars are becoming vast. And here is one of the robust Australopithecines, you can see the size of the mandible, the size of the molars, and of course the associated musculature. And this is something that we can pick up. And most of the fossils that you find from this period are robust Australopithecines or showing some signs of robusticity and megadontic adaptations. So again, if we were able to leap into a time machine and go and explore this period, we probably wouldn't occur to us that these were going to evolve into humans, because the main thing that was going on was a trend towards megadontic evolution. And in this period, and there's the species largely sorted out in terms of chronology. The thing that later became Homo, the Homo ergaster, Homo erectus trends that we pick up from about 2 million years ago, are probably a very small localized pocket within a much broader pattern of robust Australopithecine, robust hominid evolution. And those robust hominids begin, the megadontic ones, begin to disappear down to about 1 million years ago. And then Homo takes over. These two events are not necessarily related, I might say. So again, the early trends of hominid evolution are not trends of encephalization, culture, technology, or anything like that. So if one was to say, one other thing here, is just that it also appears, to my mind, and I think most interesting, you could make a case that these megadontic trends, in fact, evolve independently a number of times. That is not a single lineage evolving robust teeth, large teeth, but that there, you could make a case that it evolves independently early on here in Afarensis, which shows some enlargement of teeth. Ethiopicus as an early East African robust Australopithecine, possibly a purely South African evolution of the same form, and then a later form perhaps evolving independently in East Africa. I should say one could put an entirely different interpretation on this, but one could make the case that what we're seeing is considerable convergence in the pattern of early hominid evolution. And the red lines, I should say, are the clades that exhibit some form of dental enlargement relative to their putative ancestors. So again, this to my mind tells us that in fact what we're seeing is strong selection taking place on small local populations and the same conditions producing the same outcomes, which is more consoling, I think, to evolutionary biologists than wonderful, unique, separate line leading in novel directions. Now, if we're going to say where in all this does the evolution of what happens to make evolution change in a major way, if we're going to start to argue that all these changes are taking place, we could ask you what's causing all these different species to evolve. And one of the most tempting answers might be that it is climate. I've already said that climatic change is occurring consistently during this period. And Elizabeth Verber has argued very strongly that during this period, and indeed generally throughout mammalian evolution, major changes in evolution are exclusively associated with climatic change. That without pulses of climatic change, you do not get major changes in evolution. And so one could argue that all this megadontic change and the emergence of Homo around about 2 million years ago is a product of climatic change. I think there are empirical problems with this, and I'm not going to go through what amounts to a lot of analysis, but if we look at a number of variables here and look at the temperature and the changes in temperature, we look at the appearance of new taxa in a number of ways in the hominids and in other species, we look at the disappearance of them, the extinction in the fossil record, and we look at the number of them and start to examine statistically the relationship between them at various times or throughout the Pleistocene, the Pliocene and the Pleistocene. One of the things that I would argue is that there is no relationship between the appearance of new taxa and climatic change during this period. That it's very difficult to show statistically that new species are more likely to arise during periods of major climatic change than they are during any other period. There are some interesting climatic relationships, and they occur, I think, round here, which is actually to do with extinction and diversity. That climate, where it does start to have an effect, does have the effect of perhaps knocking out species. It certainly has ecological effects in determining how many species are around, but that it's impossible to show that climate is the driving force. So if we're looking for a theory of human evolution, it's unlikely to be climate. I think there are a number of good theoretical reasons why it's unlikely to be climate too in this way. It's exactly how climate operates, because species compete with each other rather than temperature bar charts. Now, if it's not climate, one could ask a number of other questions and ask whether it's to do with changes in foraging and ecology. I'm sorry, this is a very dark slide. I won't keep it for very long. I think, again, the overall pattern of the fossil record tells us about the processes and mechanisms involved. And ignore this one here. This just shows a relationship between different time periods, 2 million, 1 million, half a million, and 100,000 years ago, between the number of hominid species in the fossil record that we recognize in the fossil record, maximum and minimum, depending on different taxonomies, compared to the number that are predicted using the distributions of living species. So some spatially generated models, the fact that there's a relationship between the area occupied by a genus or a family and the number of species. And what's interesting, this is the fit. So this is the prediction and this is the data. So it's not a very good fit here. We would predict far more species than we actually find. But what's interesting is down here, we do find a reasonable fit 2 million years ago between the number of species and the expected number for an ordinary catarrhine. But what becomes interesting is that once we move out of this period, the fit becomes appalling. If you start to look at models based on carnivores and omnivores, then you get a much better relationship. So what it looks as if is happening as you move into the later phases of human evolution, as you move into Homo, then the broad pattern of evolution is becoming less like that of a typical catarrhine and more like that of something else. I don't quite know what that something else is. It would be tempting to say it's to do with carnivory, and there are good reasons why carnivory could be very, very important and has ecological and evolutionary effects, in that carnivores tend to be much less habitat-specific than herbivores. And so you get, they also have much larger geographic, much larger home ranges and day ranges and territories, and therefore they're more likely to expand, so that you could be seeing in this period a change. So the shift from this early Australopithecine megadontic change is consistent in evolutionary patterns with some sort of change in foraging as well. Now, of course, you could say it also to do with technology. But about 2 million years ago, you begin to see stone tool technology. By 1.5 million years ago, there's some very sophisticated piece of stone out there, hand axes, bifacially worked pieces. Technology is likely to be very important, but it's not necessarily the case that it is working in the same way. And all I would say is that these technologies are stable over a million years or more. So technology is important, but it's not a flexible pattern. We could just turn very briefly to the question of whether, what I'm saying is that everything is being packed, everything early is nothing to do with human evolution. Does this mean that therefore all the changes that we're interested in are really only occurring very late in human evolution? That we're looking at the very end of a whole series of processes. Now, what I want to just briefly look at here is, if you look at the taxa and you try and extrapolate out a number of traits about them which might be telling us about how close to human behavior they are, we can see how they change across time. And here's a number relating to the brain, so here's cranial capacity and body size corrected cranial capacity and neocortex ratio. And if we look at them, we find they're showing different patterns. Cranial capacity and EQ are changing relatively rapidly, relatively late, whereas neocortex is a very gradual changing process. If we look at technology measured in terms of how complex the technology is or how stable it is, this changes rapidly in the last 200,000 or 300,000 years. There's a more gradual change there, but again, it's very late. But if we look instead over here at some other biological changes, our estimates of changing rates of growth during human evolution, growth slows down, rates of growth slow down, maturation is delayed. That appears to occur much more continuously across this whole range. So although much of what I've been saying is pushing our evolution back rather further into the past, sorry, rather further forward than we might have thought, in other words, that later human evolution is where it's all happening, it's quite clear that some things are beginning much earlier, around about 1.5 million years ago, and that there is an acceleration around about 3 million years or so. Let me finally, just to finish off, and I've got just about 5 more minutes, say a little about the very final bit, because I've left everything here towards the problem of modern human origins, where Homo sapiens is coming from in the last 100,000 years or so, and whether this is the key event. Maybe this is where the package is put together: language, culture, technology, brains, violence, whatever you want to do. There's certainly a major rate increase, an acceleration in the various changes over the period, certainly from 300,000 years ago. All I want to do is just to say, in looking at the modern evidence, the genetic evidence, the paleontological evidence, the archaeological evidence, in fact, there is not a great deal of chronological concordance between them. When people talk about the mitochondrial data and the coalescence, it looks as if we're talking about events that might be spread somewhere from about 350,000 years down to 160, with an expected probable period of around about 200,000 years ago. Anatomically, modern humans, as far as we can tell, don't evolve until 140,000, 150,000 years ago, and in fact, full modernity, or in fact, indeed, anatomical evolution continues right the way through this period. There is very little sign of changes in behavior in this period here until much later, and indeed many of the changes are occurring around about 40,000 years ago in some parts of the world. And then much of the nuclear genetics and things, it's actually telling us about very, very recent population movements and so on. So the origins of modern humans, if that's what we're looking at here, is not a single event, but is actually a continuous process occurring over that whole period. So again, any theory that we might be interested in is going to have to deal with the whole of that. So, what is the explanation? Do we have a theory for this? Well, the answer that I would got is certainly no, I don't have a theory for it, so I'm sorry if I've kept you here from your wine unnecessarily. But as I said at the beginning, it's not that surprising that we don't have a theory, because we need to be more precise about the question. And chronologically and evolutionarily speaking, it seems to me that there are a number of different events which will require different explanations over this period. For most of the people who are not specialists in human evolution, the key question is more likely to be relate to issues to do with the very end of the process. When did language evolve? Why did language evolve? Intelligence, culture, the whole complex, the whole catastrophe, as one might call it. I don't have a theory for that, but I might just sort of mention a couple of pointers which might be interesting. And the first is that there is a lot of interest and emphasis on social factors in evolution. The idea that social evolution is driving most things, and that it's driving the brain, and it's driving reproduction and so on. And I wouldn't argue with that, but I would say that's not going to explain anything as a theory unless we're much more specific about what we mean by sociality and what particular social behaviors are doing the driving of evolution. Are we talking about social behavior between groups, within groups, within the same sex or between sexes, and so on? And it seems to me that one of the things that one can note with interest is that if you look at the whole evolution of the hominoid clade, the ape clade, what we find is no evidence for large complex social groups based on female kin bonding, but we do find in chimpanzees we find an absence of female kin bonding. We find in chimpanzees the development of male kin bonding, and that brings with it, if this is an important social characteristic of the lineage, it brings with it a number of characteristics to do with the relationships between groups, that relationships between groups will tend to be antagonistic, competitive, and territorial rather than friendly, and as a result of that, and particularly in that case, large group size is very strongly favored, and where large group size is favored, you then have a whole series of consequences for ecological resource availability, and so on. So I think I would be interested in looking more closely at that. I've lost the slide. Did I get? Yes, and the other thing that I again, it may well be that the pressures are social, but let's remember that the brains necessary for dealing with social problems are extremely expensive biological tissues. That that the brain, the metabolism of the brain, the growth of the brain is strongly correlated with energetics, and that the human brain takes up something like 20% of the available energy in maintenance. For a chimpanzee, it's only about 8.5%. That energy has to come from somewhere. So that if you're going to argue for a social model driving hominid evolution, underlying it is going to be ecological, environmental, and energetic changes which allow it to be possible. The benefits can only be afforded if the costs can be minimized or met somewhere. And so there will be changes in parenting, changes in behavior, changes in ecology. And that's where I would be looking for the conditions under which evolutionary change might occur. And in terms of the very latest part of hominid evolution, it seems to me that what we really need to do is, if we're going to say that that is where a lot of these changes are concentrated, we have to ask, what are the sorts of conditions during the last 300,000 years that might lead to greater social complexity, that might lead to greater patterns of geographical distribution? So, do we need a theory of human evolution? Well, yes, we do, but I don't think we need any special theories. I'd be much happier starting with some with the sort of vast array of evolutionary models that are used for other species and seeing how they work with humans. And then we can test whether the conditions necessary for certain things to evolve do actually apply to the specific place and time. I think also the theories should bear in mind that we're dealing with a microevolutionary problem. There's a terrible tendency to look at the consequences of human evolution and therefore assume that the causes must be massive as well. In origins, I think we're dealing with a very small microevolutionary demographic change which led to changes which became very significant, but we should not necessarily expect massive macroevolutionary, speciational, punctuational, or any other sorts of change necessarily underlying it. And finally, and the most important, the sort of the paleontologist's plea, I suppose, which is that, well, the paleontologist's plea is usually for more money, but we'll forget that one. The paleontologist's plea, which is that human evolution occurred at a particular time and in a particular place. And it is that we need to explain, not the occurrence of somewhere in the vast universe or any of the parallel universes that I've referred to of human evolution, but why did it occur, where it did, when it did, in the pattern it did. And my expectation is that, like any explanation in evolutionary biology, it will turn out to be a relatively messy theory involving both some broad, general, energetically, ecologically based rules with some historical contingent factors. But perhaps I'll leave it to somebody else to work out what those might be. Thank you very much.
I'd like people, when asking questions, to tell us who they are and to speak as loudly as they can, and either Bob or I will repeat the question so that the audience hears it.
Yes, I'm not for a minute saying that it's not special. What I'm arguing is that we can have unique special traits which aren't necessarily the product of a very special mechanism. I mean, we don't necessarily need to then look for extraordinary mechanisms or non-Darwinian mechanisms. It seems to me we can at least see whether the run-of-the-mill mechanisms work. And equally, we perhaps want to, before we get carried away with how different our brain is, we should look for some general rules as to what makes animals have larger than expected brains. I mean, there's a lot of work being done, say, on relative brain size, which says, well, yes, humans have very large brains. They're much larger relative to their body size than other species. But let's look at what happens to other species that have brains that are a little bit larger than you would expect, or substantially larger than you expect, and what sorts of general features account for them. So it's not in any sense saying that something special hasn't happened, but it's saying to what extent can we minimize the assumptions we make in explaining those. I mean, the other point I was trying to make is not that brain, the expansion of the brain isn't important, but I think it's important for only part of hominid evolution. In other words, hominid evolution is a big, big subject of which human evolution, brain expansion, culture and so on is a very small part. The most interesting part I'm prepared to accept, but... Sorry, do you want to come back? Yes. Yes. The question there was, could some of the expansion of the brain be explained by a positive feedback? I assume that you have in mind some sort of positive feedback whereby, by being more intelligent to solve complex problems, you create more complex problems which require you to be more intelligent. Yes, almost certainly. But I think as a methodological issue, what we would have to ask is, well, that's surely going to happen to all neurological evolution. All species ought to do better if they were that bit smarter. Even a cow would presumably do slightly better if it was slightly more intelligent. So the other side of any evolutionary question is, what are the costs? And it's a question of balancing the advantages of getting stuck in a feedback loop like that, so it is getting bigger and bigger, and what sorts of processes are holding it in check. I mean, the interesting question to me is, let us assume that something was holding the expansion of the brain in check up until, say, 300,000 years ago. But then it appears that you get this increase. It's not vastly faster than other organs can evolve in other animals, but it does occur relatively quickly. So what sorts of changes could be occurring at that time? And that's certainly, it's a specific question about a particular place and time. There was somebody. No. Put me out of business, huh?
What occurs to me is that whatever argument you want to make, if bipedal locomotion is what really drives it, then why did all those others that had bipedal locomotion die out? And when you think about large brains, you see all of the brain size getting larger and larger, and still extinction, so that not any one of those things can be the thing that gets us to be here.
Yes. Did everyone? No. The question is. That's a long question. John, you can summarize that one. The question was at least it ended up as to really why so many of these lineages became extinct. If, as it were, they're undergoing the same evolutionary trends that make us so successful, why are these other guys not making it? That's really what it boils down to. The Stephen Gould answer would be, we could be a bunch of Neanderthals sitting in a room like this, discussing why these round-headed, small-faced hominids that appeared in Africa 100,000 years ago became extinct when they seemed just as good as us Neanderthals. So it could just be a stochastical blip. We were the lucky ones, they were not. I'm never very happy with that sort of explanation. So I would look for something more than that. A general answer is that we tend to overestimate. Again, it's because we look at how successful we are today. We overestimate the significance of humans, hominids in the Pleistocene. I actually think that they were very, very precariously placed in many of the environments in which they were living, and that you have small isolated populations subject to all the things that small isolated populations are, that they tend to become extinct. So rather than having great swathes of hominids running around Asia and Africa, what we probably had are small populations, and we're just picking up bits and pieces of this in the fossil record. There's much more variability, much more going on. And those extinctions have nothing, as it were, to do with another larger brained hominid coming in and sweeping them to extinction, but the fact that they'd already become extinct by the time that happened. But that all the time there was a persistence of some populations somewhere. I won't go into that one. Yes, is that... Chris?
Could you speak up a bit?
Sorry. The question is if Darwinism has to be unboring, run-of-the-mill. There is, of course, a very different tradition within Darwinism, including several themes of Darwinism. It argues that evolution is, in a sense, immortality, the immortality of genes. And there's an emergence of symbolic culture. We have the emergence of a new level of immortality, symbolic immortality, or meaning of immortality. I've read, or tried to read rather, a long and complex book called Major Transitions in Evolution. One of the authors is standing on the platform. This is about the origin of the cell, the origin of multicellular organisms, and eventually about the origins of symbolic culture, including speech. And as far as I can work out, it was respectively Darwinian ground, but it did argue that costs can exceed benefits, keep on exceeding benefits for a particular innovation which might otherwise be perfect, until a certain critical mass or frequency dependence effect comes into play, then relatively suddenly, a multicellular organism or speech becomes possible. I'm not quite sure what's your motivation in trying to argue that the emergence of anatomically modern humans and this extraordinary current revolution, and that the outcome of some rather boring, run-of-the-mill process.
Was that a question addressed to you? I think it was about a paper of yours rather than mine that he was talking about.
You have a word and then I'll have a really big word on it.
Okay.
The problem again goes back to causes and consequences. It seems to me that I'm very happy to accept that Darwinism or Darwinian change, can produce some spectacular consequences. I mean, the evolution of life has to be considered as such. But that, and I don't think I've said anything that for a moment suggested that wasn't the case. What I was arguing was that the causes of such changes needn't necessarily be that odd. In other words, the circumstances may occur in frequency terms relatively rarely, but that they're nothing, they're not the sorts of spectacular people visiting from Mars types of things that you could get out into if you really started to say, well, very unusual things are necessary to explain human evolution. And so I don't see any conflict with what I've said with the view. I'd hardly be a Darwinian biologist if I really thought it was terribly boring. I know what you're driving at, because I've read your book too. And that is that of course, you would argue, I think, that there are major changes that occur at a particular place at a particular time, and that those have, that in other words, you would compress an awful lot of evolutionary change
into one episode. And I suppose I would, to some extent, question whether I can identify that episode empirically, but that's another matter. What I would certainly question is, in fact, whether the evidence shows that everything is occurring at one time. It seems to me that it's extended over a much more prolonged period of time. And we're seeing a whole series of multiple events. And symbolism, the evolution of symbolism, symbolic explosion, is clearly part of that. But I don't think it's a kind of sudden neurological mutation, and suddenly humans are capable of symbolism, and therefore all sorts of things change. I think, to my mind, the symbolic change, or the changes that one sees in the very late Pleistocene to do with the Upper Paleolithic and so on, I don't actually see them as being symbolic explosion. I see it as a demographic explosion, to be quite honest. And that, my tendency would be to go and look for ecological reasons. But
well, it seems that you mentioned, implied, that Earth's South Mario ought to be here to answer your question. Maybe I'll say a word or two about it. I mean, we did argue in our book that there had been, a relatively small number of rather major changes, but we did define them in a quite specific context. I mean, that they were changes in the way in which information is stored and transmitted. And the task we set ourselves very consciously was that even though these changes could have dramatic consequences, it was our job to at least suggest an explanation in terms of simple Darwinian selection and mutation. I mean, we didn't want to invoke macronutation or genetic revolution or anything that we can't understand. We wanted to do it in old-fashioned Darwinian terms, but we granted that the consequences were dramatic. I'm not sure that I actually disagree with Bob in any way, but I think I would emphasize the story rather differently. That the thing that boggles my mind, which is something he mentioned, is that our ancestors went on making boring old habits, if you like, for a million years, a point that he made, without any continuous cultural change. Nowadays, we can't go on making the same computer for more than a year before somebody changes the language or something like that. I can't use them anymore. We now have rapid, continuous cultural change. Yet our ancestors, relatively short time ago in evolutionary terms, had cultural constancy and uniformity. And the change from the one mode to the other, of course, in explanation, we suggest that the explanation has to be language, but honestly, because certainly I cannot think what else it could be. But nor do I do not for one moment believe that the language organs in constantly say was the consequence of a genetic revolution or a mutation. It must have been the consequence of some kind of protracted genetic event. I doubt if you really disagree about that.
No, I wouldn't at all. I mean, I think the problem, or one of the problems I see, is that if we look at, as far as we can tell, both genetically and morphologically, the origins of Homo sapiens go back around about 150,000 years ago, and we're seeing this dispersal or series of dispersals out of Africa and backwards and forwards into Africa, for all I know, too, throughout that period. Only really for the whole of that period, with anatomically modern humans, we're still evolving in some morphological way. What is it, 60,000 years later, do you find this symbolic explosion? And you only find the symbolic explosion in a few parts of Europe, possibly one or two other areas as well. There's a Mediterranean to Western farm. So either you're going to say this is something which occurred much earlier, but they were so busy, maybe they had speech impairment or something like that, and they didn't quite get it together for a long time. Or else you've got serious problems about how this then spreads around the world and becomes differentiated subsequently. So this is why I'm actually more interested in saying that I think there are major changes, biological changes, going on probably over 100,000 years ago, which I think are to do with language. I'd put it much, much further back than some people would. And that what we're then seeing is a lot of population movements which create a whole series of new demographic contexts, which ultimately end in agriculture and civilization and so on, in which that cultural capacity, that the symbolic
things, suddenly takes on an enormously new role and a more important role. But it's quite clear that humans, probably with the same capacities as we've got, were quite happily using their symbols quietly to themselves for several tens of thousands of years.
I mean, if I can just add a brief word, I mean, I think that the thing that I find puzzling is not the thing that you describe, but it's something which I've only recently, very recently, in the last few years, become conscious, that there is this contrast between the origin of anatomically modern humans, some 50 to 100,000 years before the symbolic revolution, and it is a puzzle. Let me just see how we do. I think this is going to have to be the last question that I'm going to ask you.
University College London. Can I just add to that one little bit to that point? Like, there's an increasing body of evidence that perhaps symbolic behaviour is going back to early upper Pleistocene in Africa. There may not be the discrepancy between anatomical modernity and some level of symbolic behaviour. It may be really centric, just focused on that kind of thing. The question I wanted to put to Rob actually is on a different subject. I think you're absolutely right in focusing on the issue of energetics of brain expansion and how that might relate to social and maintenance and behavioural development, especially in those rapid phases of urbanization, the late stage of evolution. But I wanted to ask a question about menopause and the evolution of menopause in relation to that model of male kingdom, where male kingdom is at the expense of female kingdom. It would seem that one of the payoffs of menopause grandmothering to his legacy and offspring. If you are grandmothering offspring of your children, you're at the expense of your own reproductive career, you need to be pretty sure that those offspring of your children are really offspring of your kingdom. And if there are children of sons,
I want to ask you to ask a very brief question. Sorry.
It may.
I know Kristen Hawkes has argued this a lot, and we've certainly discussed it. I think, as it were, if there is this conflict between menopause and male kin bonding, which you're positing, as it were, something's got to go. So either we've got to come up with another explanation of menopause, or else another explanation of the social systems. Which one's going to go? My guess is that actually there are other explanations of male kin bonding, and Turk has a model of the evolution of menopause, which is in fact to do with female competition rather than grandmothering. And so I think there are other explanations. There are also various things that might be to do with the evolution of when longevity does evolve. But I mean, I recognize it's a problem, but I don't think it's a fatal one.
let me just first of all make an announcement that the art of the but before you go, I do have one very sensitive and that is to give our contributors a small present. And first of all, Myrna, can I talk about the other analogy? This is a strange book by Lord Human Support and Management, written by somebody called Robert Ferdy. Is also present to you, which basically is given to you to demonstrate that your sons actually have a clearer idea of what evolution is all about than you do. They know that it's dinosaurs that really matter. And we have even t-shirts with dinosaurs on.
I wonder.
And finally, one for Myrna, one for Rob, and one for me. And hello, tell us what they are. Yeah.